You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, March 17th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Brittany De La Creta and Lindsay D'Arcangelo, authors of Hail Mary, The Rise and Fall of the National Women's Football League. Meanwhile, Ukraine has launched counterattacks outside of Kyiv and Russian-held Kherson. As Russia continues its assault, the southern port city of Mariupol continues to face intense attacks. And the theater in the city where hundreds of civilians were sheltering was bombed by Russia, it seems. No word on the extent of the damage or casualties yet. Yesterday, Biden announced $800 million in new military aid to Ukraine, including the sale of kamikaze drones, so the defense industry is salivating. The fate of WNBA star Brittany Griner continues to be up in the air. Russian authorities have extended her detention to May 19th for empty cannabis vape cartridges. As diplomats on both sides reportedly attempt to salvage Obama's Iran deal, Israel and Iran are escalating their covert actions against one another to be not that covert anymore. The UN has fallen short of its over $4 billion global goal to aid Yemen as it falls into humanitarian catastrophe, raising only $1.3 billion of that. That is on the entire world, including, and especially in this case, the United States. The Fed has raised interest rates for the first time since 2018 by a quarter of a percentage point in order to curb inflation, they say. And lastly, Democrats are considering a package that would ostensibly lower gas prices, including a gas tax holiday. We shall see what they come up with. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. It is an Majority Report Thursday. So it's me, Bradley, Matt. We will be joined later by Matt Binder, Brandon Sutton. Got a great show. Of course, I forgot to headline the most important news story of today, the day, which is that Nancy Pelosi is reading a poem by Bono to save Ukraine today. Good for her.
Hope it's stuck in a moment.
Yeah. Which U2 song will she maybe invoke during this poem reading? Because the kneeling in the kente cloth, that helped with police brutality. The Hamilton cast on January 6th, that ended the far-right movement in this country. And the anti-democratic fascist movement in this country. So now she's got to take a page out of Annalyn McCord's book. And
yeah, bringing in the edge on guitar would be seen as too much of an escalation.
I mean, honestly, as you said before the show, Matt, I thought we were trying to avoid this war escalation. Think this might just inflame tensions just a bit, but we have a little bit more substantive things to talk about in terms of inflaming tensions here. So I've talked about this a bit on the show about how the Republicans had trouble kind of coalescing behind a message when it came to Ukraine and Russia's invasion and war in Ukraine. You had the traditional hawks saying all the same things, escalation, escalation, escalation. We played a clip from Candace Owens on the program yesterday where she was just regurgitating Putin talking points. And then you have Tucker Carlson, who's kind of landing on the, this is not our problem. I think we need to maintain U.S. hegemony in another way. But this is always going to be the more dominant narrative in the Republican power centers, because Republicans are war hawks. There is no appetite, I believe, in the United States for a war with Russia among the general citizenry. I think supporting Ukraine is very popular, as it should be. But war with Russia, not so much.
Famously, back during the Obama administration, during the whole red line thing, there was a study that showed the more Americans knew where Ukraine was, the less they were supportive of America intervening in any sort of capacity in the area.
I mean, then that makes total sense, right? Based on just the common sense about what war with Russia would mean. But there is appetite for something like this, at least military escalation among Republican power brokers and you know, some Democrats as well. But we've talked about Lindsey Graham. He's very vocal about this. But there are people more behind the scenes who are supportive of escalation, including a senator like John Kennedy, who continues to push for, and you'll hear it here, increased actions by the United States in regards to Ukraine. Here he is on Sean Hannity's program last night, talking about Biden's response.
Senator, you not only watched President Zelensky, but I'm quoting you. You said we are at war with Russia. We need to win it militarily and economically. I want you to give us a little more detail what you mean by that.
Well, I'd make a couple of points, Sean. First, I think it's clear that the leader of the free world is President Zelensky. He and the Ukrainian people are tough as a boot, and we need to have their back. Point two, I think it's important when we do something right to acknowledge it. The West's sanctions on Russia's central bank has hurt Putin. Hadn't brought him to his knees, but it's hurting. So I suppose you could say President Biden has gotten it right once in a row. Point three, the rest of President Biden's economic response to the invasion and military response to the invasion, in my judgment, has been a wimp fest. Let's take it first militarily. President Zelensky and the Ukrainian people are holding their own on the ground. They need air cover. Today, President Zelensky said, can you please help me get planes? Can you please help me get surface-to-air missiles? I'm not asking for American planes or pilots. Our troops, help me with your allies. President Biden's response is the same as it always is. I'll get back to you in 3 to 5 business days. Uh-huh. And he never gets back.
Senator, point four, go ahead. You go ahead, sir. Finish your point.
I was just going to say the final point I would make, unless you're still living with your parents, you understand that you can't put Putin on his knees without cutting off his cash flow. And you can't cut off his cash flow without cutting off his oil and gas. And a lot of our allies say, well, we have to buy his oil and gas. Where are we going to get it? Well, the obvious answer is the United States, except for one problem. The woker darlings and the Democratic Party will not allow President Biden to adopt an all-of-the-above energy policy, which includes oil and gas, and the president just doesn't seem to have the courage to stand up to him.
Courage. I don't know what woker darlings means. That's some sort of old-timey reference there.
Yeah, not quite hitting that.
Yeah, and he tried a few times with the 3 to 5 business days thing. Those are some pre-prepared remarks. But let's go through with, what Kennedy said here, because I think it's indicative of the Republican response. Hannity quotes him at the beginning, we are already at war with Russia, or we are at war with Russia. No, we're not. I mean, yes, sanctions are an act of war. Notice that is the one thing that Kennedy approved of there. I am sympathetic with Biden's move to implement sanctions because I felt he needed to act. But let's just be real that those are going to be offset onto the Russian people to a degree.
We talked about this last night with Carl about the do somethingism, I think, is a problem because you see immediately how this plays out is it doesn't just affect the oligarchs. We're going to cut down credit card stuff and that's going to impact Russians trying to flee Russia. Mm-hmm. We should be accepting not only Ukrainian refugees, but Russian refugees if we're going to impose this sort of brutal sanctions that are going to impact a lot more than just oligarchs.
Yeah. But point being, to Matt's point, like, that is why Kennedy says he gets it right once in a row, yeah. Because that's the kind of do something ism that the Republicans want here. But he says that we have to, quote, have their back when referring to the Ukrainians. And what does that entail? We are selling arms to them. We are increasingly selling defense. I've headlined this earlier that the Biden administration is working to sell them kamikaze drones, which are high tech and lethal. We are selling arms to them. The only next escalation is a no-fly zone, boots on the ground, something to that degree, which is something that would spark such an intense and bloody chain reaction that I think nobody in the Biden administration, I should say, seems to want to go down that road. But, like, you know, I heard all the time about how Russiagate was a bunch of drummed up BS, but it was the Democrats that wanted to go to war with Russia. That's what we heard all the time, because they were using, I think, in a very misguided and stupid way, Russia's favorability towards Trump as some sort of political tool, which did not benefit them actually in any way in the end. But this is always who wants to go to war. It's the hawks. Yeah. And there are more hawks in the Republican Party, more people like John Kennedy who are pushing this kind of stuff than there are in the Democrats. We have a Democratic president who, yes, has implemented sanctions, but has been fairly steadfast. And I approve of this.
Yep.
With no-fly zone, which means shooting down Russian planes, escalating towards a war with Russia, and no U.S. military personnel involved in the conflict. That is the right course of action, but know that there are always these voices behind the scenes who are pushing more escalation, because listen to what he said at the end there, too. He's a disaster capitalist. John Kennedy represents Louisiana, oil and gas, would be the industry, a dominant industry in Louisiana. He would benefit very greatly, and his donors would, from increased domestic drilling and oil production in North America and in the United States. I said this when Russia invaded, when there was the push to cut off Russian oil and gas. This is what the centrists and the Republicans and the conservatives in this country are going to push for. More oil coming out of North America, going down this green track, what a huge mistake, more money for my donors, etc. And then, of course, more money for defense contractors, the military-industrial complex, in an escalation. Those are the twin interests that Kennedy is representing, let alone, you know, his own proclivities towards do somethingism, as you say.
Yeah, I absolutely think if someone like Nikki Haley was president, that we'd be shooting down Russian planes. Like, or she says as much. Maybe the reality of office would like chill her out a little bit, but
we don't want to bank on that.
Exactly, absolutely. And I think, like, even in the Democratic administration, like, I think there's probably a lot of people really just look at the way the press corps is reacting. Like, there's definitely Democrats that want Biden to do a lot more as well. And I don't support the sanctions stuff very much. I'm extremely skeptical of that and think it might be a massive, massive mistake. But that said, Biden's holding the line on the no-fly zone stuff needs to be, like, encouraged.
Absolutely. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be joined by Brittany De La Crata and Lindsay D'Arcangelo, authors of Hail Mary, The Rise and Fall of the National Women's Football League. We'll be right back. are back, and we are joined by the authors of Hail Mary, The Rise and Fall of the National Women's Football League, Brittany De La Creta and Lindsay D'Arcangelo. Thank you guys so much for being here today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
So I'm a notorious female sports fan on the show. I talk about sports to a degree that I think half our audience isn't that into. But I'm really embarrassed to say that I knew until reading your book very little about the National Women's Football League. Frankly, the only time I've seen women play football on TV was that, you know, growing up, I would have NFL Network on and they had that lingerie football league on, which at the time I was, even as a kid, I went, there's something wrong here. I mean, what inspired you both to write this book and I guess from a big picture view, what are your reflections on women's relationship to football in modern American culture?
I will say that you should not be embarrassed because I know women's sports historians that have never heard of this league. So I think that that's pretty common. We did not know about this league either. And we came across it while researching a larger women's football project. We were trying to write a book about women in football much more broadly, and that book didn't sell. It didn't have much of a narrative arc, but in looking into that, we discovered the NWFL and the Toledo Troopers, the winningest team in pro football history. And in digging into their record, we found they were playing other teams, but we could not find anything else about those teams or about that league. And I think it became very, very quickly clear that this was the book that we wanted to write. And so we went from there. And I think, you know, in terms of big picture thoughts about women's football, that's a big question, but I will say for me, and Lindsay may have something different to add here, but what was most surprising to me about writing this book was about how little has changed when it comes to the landscape of women's football and how the leagues that are operating today are still operating very much in the vein of the way that the NWFL operated on these shoestring budgets, you know, selling raffle tickets to play games, not getting any money to be on the field and things like that. And so I think for me, that was the most jarring, was really how little progress there has been in some ways.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that sentiment. Seeing the similarities and some of the same struggles and hurdles that women's football players and leagues and teams have to deal with today was kind of jarring.
Yeah. And what struck me really is, in reading your book, how, there's a kind of post Title IX, shift a little bit, but it doesn't really apply to football, right? I mean, tackle football is perceived as aggressive, and aggression is not incentivized as a quality for women and girls. And I can say this in terms of like, politics a little bit. There are very few women in my field because I think that there's a lot of times, or in progressive media specifically, because I think a lot of times speaking your mind to that degree about politics can be perceived as aggressive. Like, you know, there have been gains made in soccer or in tennis for women and girls, not enough, but that's because they're more aerobic and less strength-based, and then that's some of the inherent misogyny in it as well, I would say. The aggression, strength building, that's more masculine, and that should not be something that women engage in. I'm curious about your thoughts on my read of those dynamics.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And we talk about this a lot when we're discussing the book and the players and the league itself. There's this view in society, because football, like you said, is such a aggressive and violent sport, a very masculine coded sport, that society has a hard time wrapping their minds around women playing it, especially at the professional level. And, you know, basketball, soccer, those sports that you mentioned, they're very much finesse sports. I mean, yes, there's physicality involved, but they're more, you know, free flowing. And, I don't know if that's more easily digestible for society, but yeah, we completely agree.
Right, because I mean, there was a passage in your book about some of the misogynistic ways that in the 1930s, I believe, there was an over 200-pound offensive lineman, female, was written about. What were some of the things that you found when you're deep research on this, because there was not a breath of material at your disposal. Like, you can't just go on, you know, whatever Pro Football Reference or the NFL database to find some of the stats that you need to see. You had to get a lot of firsthand accounts from people.
Yeah, we did. And a lot of our research, you know, the beginning of our research comes from the newspapers, because these leagues and these teams were considered a curiosity. And so all the way back through history, you know, in the 1930s, like you noted, there was some organized women's football being played, and those games, as well as the NWFL games, were covered very much as a curiosity. And the longer those that the NWFL went on, the less media coverage there was. And The league was covered very much with a focus on the women's appearance. If they were very, very large women, that was played up. There was a lot of fat phobia, and comments about the weight of, you know, the linebackers, the linemen. We had, you know, if they were attractive, that was played up as well, because there is something threatening to the status quo about more masculine women. And so it was very important for reporters to play up when women were attractive so that they weren't seen as too threatening. And there was also this focus on the players being, you know, women's libbers, because this is during the 70s, during second wave feminism. And so even though the players themselves didn't really associate with the movement, you see the newspapers really trying to shoehorn that in, and asking questions about their male partners and things like that. And so that coverage really is done through the lens of the people who are writing about it. And the people who were writing about it then were largely men. And so a lot of the research that we did came firsthand and from materials that the players had held on to. We tried really to get their perspective back in, because it had been so thoroughly erased by the media at the time.
So I want to talk about, you know, the NWFL's origins, but first I just kind of want to back up to talk about football's origins, because I part of why this topic is important, it's not just women's sports in general, but the NFL is the most popular sport in our country, or football is. It is a cultural staple. I mean, that's part of why I enjoy it. I love the collectivism of it and the collective experience. But of course, that comes with like a massive exclusionary element, because when the 50% of the population have not have been historically excluded from that, both culturally and as players. So take us back to the late 1800s. Women's interest in football predates the NWFL NWFL, right, as you write.
Yeah, I mean, throughout our research, we discovered and found many examples of women participating and playing football or trying to organize teams and actually getting a few teams off the ground and having little round robins themselves throughout the course of history since the sport was invented. The late 1800s, as you referenced, there was a game between Yale and what was the other school? I think it was Harvard.
Harvard Yale.
And you know, they were putting on a men's social club event, and they gathered women from each school and pinned the school colors on them and had them play sort of like an exhibition game for fun and for entertainment for the guys. But when the women actually got on the field to play, I mean, they took it extremely seriously. And the game started, you know, getting a little rough, and the police had to be called in because the crowd was getting really excited. And the whole description, you know, in the newspaper at the time, you know, could read like a scene out of a movie. And that just showcased really that early on that women, you know, found interest in this sport and could play when given the opportunity. And so from there on, up until the NWFL kicked off, there were many times, as I said before, of women who tried to play, you know, at high schools, or just, you know, there was a high schooler in Alabama who went out for her team as a kicker. at 17 years old just to prove that she could. I mean, we could go back through and name a ton. And then eventually in the 1960s, there was a man by the name of Sid Friedman. He was a promoter and quote unquote sports agent for a baseball player. And he saw this sort of curiosity and the novelty of women's football, women playing football sort of growing and catching on. And he decided just to create a team akin to the Harlem Globetrotters, women's football team, women's football troop, really, to play and compete against men teams around the Rust Belt area. He was from Cleveland, Ohio. And he got a team off the ground. And when he put out word in the newspaper to have these women, to have women come try out, he got so many women who were interested, and not only interested, they really wanted to play and have the opportunity to play. And he formed a team, and they did play other men's teams, and they held their own. And so he decided to create another women's team and then another women's team. And he sort of had this conglomerate of teams playing against each other throughout Pennsylvania and in Cleveland and in Buffalo, around those areas. And that's really what served as the launching pad for the NWFL, because owners around the country were honing in on this and decided to start teams in different parts of the country, and eventually got together separate of Sid Friedman to form the NWFL. But yeah, that's really sort of the timeline progression.
So that does hit on another point that I wanted to touch on, which is so there were capitalists, eventually owners, that saw that this could be profitable or thought that this could be, but it seems like, at least in the origin of the idea, only as a kind of spectacle a la Harlem Globetrotters, as you say. What did you find in some of your research there, and what these owners and capitalists thought would be the best way for them to get profit out of any women's league?
Yeah, so I think that women's football, you know, the men who started these teams, as you said, it really was a gimmick. And someone like Sid Friedman, who was a promoter, you know, he's had this huge influence on the game of women's football, and it wouldn't exist today without his vision. But at the same time, he was really in it to make money, and he did not really care as much about how the women were represented in the press and how he was going to do it. If it was going to make him money, he was in. And so for him, having these women wear potentially like tearaway skirts, and he would, you know, send photographers from Hustler magazine to practices, and they'd like get under the center to try to get photographs, things like that. He just saw it as part of promoting this outfit that he, you know, this vision that he had and whatever it took. And so there was a very like exploitative element to that. And the reason that many of the women broke off and decided to go independent was because they did not want to be exploited, and they wanted to be taken seriously as football players. However, what Sid Friedman and many of the male owners of the NWFL teams, there were some player-owned teams, but most were owned by men. The thing that they failed to realize was that any sports league takes a long time to become profitable, and there has to be a lot of time and investment before there's ever like a return on that money. And a lot of these men, some of them really wanted to see the women's game take off, and others really were in it to make a quick buck. They thought they could bring this to their town, their city, and people would come and they would see profits, you know, within a year or two. Not only is that really just like not how any sports league functions, most take about 10 years to see any profit.
Yeah.
Women's teams in particular, and like a brand new team, often take longer because they're up against, you know, the sexism and the belief that they can't play, and they just don't get the same. And so the NWFL itself was really never given a chance to fully succeed, because a lot of the men who had invested, when they didn't like see profits right away, they either ran out of money or they weren't willing to put any more in.
And being unwilling to put, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. You can keep going.
No, I was done.
Oh, okay. the being unwilling to stick it out, that is like, that's gotta be That's something that's so embedded with misogyny in and of itself, right? Because I think for owners in more established leagues, the owning an all-male team is a point of pride. You're more willing to, like, I mean, we saw this through the pandemic. Owners took a hit in the NFL because in many stadiums there weren't any fans, but like they stick it out not because of the quick buck element, but because they understand that owning a sports team in one of the 32 of one of the 32 teams in the country is, it's not like the number one thing you can do for profit, but you become a cultural staple in and of itself. And the unwillingness to stick it out. I mean, I'm curious if what your opinions were in terms of just, you know, that there's misogyny in that. And then it also perpetuates culture, the misogyny in culture, because the longevity is so fleeting, I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, the NWFL was up against so many factors, not having the time investment, not having the money investment, two main things that men's leagues are afforded and have always been afforded that women's leagues haven't. The fact that football is such we said earlier, a masculine-coded sport. But then you also have the fact that the men's teams in the NFL had already been around for a while. There were already established fan bases. And then you add college football to that, where those fans travel and follow their, the players from college to the pros.
And so those players don't get paid to talk about another.
Yeah. So, keep going. So women's football players were up against all of that. You know, how can you expect fans to go to a game once and come in, become invested in the Houston Hurricanes when they have no tie? There was no time to build up that fan base. And the fact that some of the owners didn't even consider that or weigh that as a factor. I mean, novelties wear off, you know, the curiosity of going to see women play a game, you know, that wears off after one or two games. And then you're like, okay. And that's sort of what happened. People moved on because the curiosity wore off, but you know, you need that time to establish the fan base, and they just weren't given that.
And there's no infrastructure for women's football, right? I mean, I was just listening to a football podcast the other day about how many great quarterbacks and receivers are coming out on the draft because those are the stars. And like in high school games, quarterbacks are it's not like the old days where it's run game focused. Quarterbacks are throwing the ball 30, 40 times a game in high school games, and receivers are getting those reps. And so like, that's why you see all these high level quarterbacks and receivers coming out in the draft. It's not like this natural thing where there's just like human beings that are plucked and they're Joe Burrow or Patrick Mahomes exist. No, it's because there's infrastructure for those specific kinds of players. There's none of that for women, not just in football too. I mean, like there it could be better in other sports, but you know, Matt, our producer, points out that little leagues have state funding. They can help in terms of fostering talent for baseball. There's none of that for women's football, and very little of that for women's sports in general.
Yeah. And if we think about the time period for the NWFL, if we talk about that, this league specifically, you know, they started in 1974, and we know Title IX was passed in 1972. And so most of the women who were playing in this league did not benefit from Title IX. So they really didn't have much of organized sports at all that they played coming up as kids. And many of these women were athletes, right? They loved the game of football. They grew up playing it with their brothers, with the neighborhood boys. They played pickup games, but that was their only exposure to organized football. And so you have fans come to what is being advertised and billed as a professional football game, and they're expecting NFL level talent. And the women were akin probably to a good high school team, but you know, to just say that takes it out of the context of they're picking up this game as adults. They're learning the fundamentals as adults. And many of them, because they were lifelong athletes or quick studies, but they have not had that same pipeline and that same investment in infrastructure. And I want to be very clear that it is not a talent gap. It is not because women are incapable of playing at the same level or, you know, that they lack skills. It's an investment gap, and it always has. And it's, you know, it still is that way. A lot of the women who play semi-pro football today, some of them will play as kids. You know, the number of girls who are playing organized football is going up, but the majority of the women playing in the semi-pro leagues, even today, they again come to the game as adults. They're lifelong athletes who discover that there's a football team and they always wanted to play. And so they show up. And so it still exists today. There's absolutely a lack of infrastructure.
Yeah. And just to build on to what Brittany just said, the pipeline, we're seeing a pipeline being created from those amateur women's football leagues, because some of the women coaching in the NFL today got their start playing in those leagues and getting that experience that men often say is required to coach at the college and pro level. And because they were actually on the field and got that experience, they were given opportunities at high schools, then colleges, and then eventually have landed in the NFL. So we can see the possibility of a pipeline being established. And if that is developed even further back, you know, at the youth and then at the high school level, giving women an opportunity to get involved in the game and get exposed to the game at an even younger age, then that pipeline will grow. And I'm not necessarily talking about tackle football, because it doesn't have to be that. It can also be, it can just be flag football. It can be some sort of way that the rules of the game and the elements of the sport can still be there and exist.
Well, so in tennis, you know, yeah, I mean, it's like silly. In tennis, they only play three sets in women's tennis, and in men's they play five. Like, it's not an all or nothing proposition in terms of playing this game. There are different rules. The XFL has different rules. College football has different rules. Rules changes happen all the time, and it can be different for a women's league 100%. I wanted to ask both of your opinions on homophobia's role in the NWFL not getting off the ground to the degree that it could. I mean, I'd imagine that there were a lot of gay players, or you did write that, and there was homophobic responses to them playing the sport. I mean, what was some of what you found in interviewing these former players, and also in terms of the archive research that you did?
Sure. I think, you know, we assumed there would be some players who were gay, and we didn't know how many would want to talk about it and whether they would see it as connected to their time in the league. And what we discovered was that many of the gay players who were in the NWFL really did see their queerness and their time in this league as very connected. And that is, you know, because there's estimates, you know, not every player was gay, of course, but somewhere between 50 to 70% of the teams were gay. And those women, some of them like knew each other from the local gay community. This is the 1970s. It is not a socially acceptable to be openly gay. So many of the players who were lesbians knew each other from their local bars. Some of them found out about the teams through their local bars where they organized softball leagues and things like that. And so in many ways, the teams they served as an extension of those communities. I think marginalized folks are really good at finding ways to create safety in a hostile world. And this is another example of that, is that the players really found a way to be together. And because there were so many of them, they could be openly who they were. However, they were also up against systemic and societal homophobia. And so there's a lot of fear of, you don't want to advertise yourself as, you know, being a lesbian. There were some teams who were afraid to allow the local lesbian bar to buy an ad space in the program because they were worried that they wouldn't be seen as family friendly if they were associated with that bar. Sometimes there would be homophobic slurs yelled at them while they were practicing. Some of the media coverage really wanted to paint them as a bunch of lesbians, and so they were really up against that. And I think we see that today too. You know, the WNBA has long wrestled with a lot of homophobia as well and trying to counteract that. But I do think that the queer history of the 70s and of this league kind of can't be erased from the narrative of it as a whole.
Yeah, and I just wanted to dive a little bit more into how Title IX affected the NWFL, because it was created in 67. Title IX was 72,
73?
72.
72. And that was around the same time Billie Jean King had her Battle of the Sexes match, which was just recently immortalized in that movie with Emma Stone. But there were a lot of women's sports was front and center to a degree. How did that affect the NWFL?
Well, it's funny because some of the players knew about Title IX and were keeping up with what was happening in the country. Other players had no idea what it was, depending on who we talked to. When we did our research, we divided the teams in the league between each other. And so we each spoke to different players on different teams and researched different teams. So we had different experiences with who we interviewed. And so, but I think for the players that I spoke to that knew about Title IX, it opened up their sports world completely. And I do think it was a motivating factor in some of them wanting to give women's football a try, because throughout their lives, they were never really given an opportunity to explore sports. And a lot of them grew up playing football with their friends and their brothers and their families. And so given this opportunity to just sort of try different sports, especially football, they jumped, you know, feet first.
Yeah. I do think it is a little bit complicated, though, because a lot of these women were adults. And so the ones that were in college actually were the ones that got to benefit the most. But what I do think was really important about Title IX, and this is also where, you know, the women's liberation movement comes in, is that what it did was it opened up this like societal conversation and readiness and awareness around women playing sports. And I think it created the atmosphere for a league like the NWFL to start, because it was something that was in the news, as you said, with Battle of the Sexes and things like that. So it was on people's radar, and I think women were able to participate in sports in a way they hadn't before, and I would credit the conversation around Title IX and women's liberation with that.
And lastly, there's really just something, and I'm curious about your read on this, both of you, because hockey is a sport that's also very brutal, right? And I think women's hockey has made more gains. I know that because the United States' women's hockey team is pretty good. I've heard, you know, I watched the Olympics four years ago when they were in it and winning a bunch of medals. And I know that, like, just anecdotally, some people I know are interested in watching that, but there's really no because American football is so American and there's not much internationalism to it, it also comes with all of the pitfalls of our like inherently misogynistic culture. Do you think that the Americanness of American football, it sounds redundant, but it's true, contributes to the inherent misogyny in the sport? Or not inherent, but the adopted misogyny, I guess.
I think that has a lot to do with it. Again, like just saying that society at large has a hard time wrapping their minds around women playing tackle football with full on pads and helmets and being that physical. It seems that it's just the same hurdle that women's football leagues today, the amateur leagues, just haven't been able to get over and really, you know, gain a foothold into the fan, into even breaking into regular football fans who watch the NFL in college, you know. You mentioned hockey, and there's no checking in women's hockey, but, you know, it still is an aggressive sport. It really doesn't take away from some of the physicality and everything, but there could be, you know, modifications to the women's game, maybe to make it more appetizing. I don't know. I don't even know if that's something they would want to do, but just giving a comparison as to what, you know, possibly could be done to just maybe help make the sport a little more digestible to try to bring in more fans.
Right. Well, I mean, there are a variety of things that can be done. It's just, you know, the impossibility of it is I overstated, and I think your book lays that out really well. So thank you guys so much for being here today. Lindsay D'Arcangelo and Brittany De La Creta, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, come back, wrap up the first hour of this program. We are back. So let's get to this clip we weren't able to get to yesterday. It's pretty remarkable. Idaho local reporter named Brian Holmes was able to get this rarefied, uninterrupted time with a politician. You do not see this on the national level, where it's a lot more of a transactional relationship. Marjorie Taylor Greene got a ton of press for going to Nick Fuentes' America First PAC conference, which was happening in Florida at the same time as CPAC, I believe. So there was some crossover. And the further right you are, there was some, maybe at least loose ties to Nick Fuentes' conference. Now it's a white nationalist conference. Obviously, you're going to get some blowback for appearing or associating with someone like Nick Fuentes. And this is a very high up Idaho politician who appeared or made an appearance. It might have been pre-recorded at Fuentes's PAC. We can confirm that in a bit. But here she is being questioned by Idaho local reporter Brian Holmes. Her name is Janice McGeachin, and she is the Idaho lieutenant governor. So no small position there. Just not being able to really get away from this interview because Brian Holmes does not let up in asking her about appearing at a white nationalist conference.
Are you familiar with who puts this event on? Like Nick Fuentes?
I don't know who he is. I don't. I've never met him. I don't know who he is.
Did you not look into it before you decided to say okay? Like to find out? I mean, his name is on it.
Well, you know what? Nick Fuentes, I don't know him. I've never met him. I don't know, you know, everything that he says or doesn't say is not.
I may have spoken at the Nick Fuentes conference for being a big right winger, but I don't know who this guy is.
Fuentes?
Does not reflect on who I am or who the thousands of others that are participating in this movement.
You didn't bother to look up his name or anything?
I didn't say that.
You did look him up.
Wait, hold on, pause it. She said that. She says she doesn't know who she is. Wait, let's go back. Right. Let's roll the tape, because pretty sure she says that she didn't know who he was, right?
Because, you know, there's certain folks that you don't need to actually meet them. You can actually learn about them online and make a judgment from there.
Yeah, but she's saying that she doesn't know who he was. So he then asks, did you Google him or look him up? So maybe she just Googled his name and didn't click on anything or put on sunglasses so she was unable to really read her computer screen. Maybe that's part of what happened.
Well, you know what? Nick Fuentes, I don't know him. I've never met him. I don't know, you know, what is... What he's everything that he says or doesn't say does not reflect on who I am or who the thousands of others that are participating in this movement.
You didn't bother to look up his name or anything?
I didn't say that.
You did look him up?
You didn't. That's not the question that you asked.
Did you look up who Nick Fuentes was and what he's talked about? Like things he has said?
I have since.
Since last week, not before?
Yes.
Okay. I guess the question is, because if you've said, well, I'm only
again,
here
it's not fair. I mean, the mainstream media, you do this to conservatives all the time, but you don't do it to yourself. That every time, anytime there's any kind of affiliation with anybody at any time on any stage, that we're all guilty by association.
Pause it.
How about name those associations? Like, you go on, trot out your like psycho Antifa conspiracy theories.
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, Nick Fuentes is a Unite the Right guy, Charlottesville guy, regularly says the N-word for fun.
Here's just a sentiment repasted from the Anti-Defamation League, where Nicholas J. Fuentes said, "What's really important to understand is that the crisis in race relations in the country basically amounts to black failure. And how do we explain the continued disparity in just about every measure?" He's basically a Charles Murray guy.
Yeah.
IQ Belker guy. So yeah, he's a big time white nationalist Nazi. And you know, if I had affiliations that were as troubling, I'd welcome conservatives to make me answer for those.
Yeah.
And just like as we are making her, look at how shifty she looks.
Well, I mean, like let's see. She's about to go off on the mainstream media and their hypocrisy. Let's see if she can come up with a counterexample. Maybe Matt that will satisfy
The Lugan press.
Here. Yeah.
With anybody at any time on any stage, that we're all guilty by association, and it's not appropriate.
But the association is not a good one, to be associated with people who are anti-Semitic.
It's not just associated with people, it's conferencing with them.
Yes. But
stop. Yes. Excuse me.
Yes.
You asked me why I was there, why I wanted to participate and speak to these young conservatives. That's what we're talking about right now.
White nationalists.
Okay. Vincent James is also there. Correct? Do you know who Vincent James is?
I've heard of him.
You've had your picture taken with him.
I did have my picture taken with him.
Okay. Do you know what he stands for and things that he has said?
No, I don't know all the things that he or anybody else. And again, I'm just going to keep repeating the same thing, that this guilt by association that the media tries to do with conservatives and conservatives only is that if we ever have met somebody once or took a picture with them or ever shared a stage with somebody ever, we're all guilty by association.
Do we remember the Jeremiah Wright thing with Obama?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's amazing, right?
Acorn.
Oh, my God. No, but, like, the Jeremiah Wright thing is such a good point, because that, like, you know, they went to town on that, and that's way more analogous, but, like, she literally just spoke at this conference.
They acted like Obama was, like, programmed by Jeremiah Wright to take down the American Empire.
Yeah, exactly. He hates America. Listen to Jeremiah Wright. All right.
If you want to know why I went there and what my message was, yes, go watch my video.
I did watch your video. And if you had
that's
known,
what it was all about.
If you had known who Nick Fuentes is, would you have said yes?
Well, again, this
is a woman who wants to continue appealing to Nazis, but not be seen publicly as appealing to Nazis.
Yes.
This movement is so much bigger than one individual. Who cares what Nick Fuentes has to say? Who cares? There's thousands and thousands.
You do,
of
apparently.
Young conservatives all across the country that are very.
Yeah, a lot of quote unquote young conservatives want to hear what this Nazi has to say.
Very concerned and about what's happening to our country. We are fighting for the soul of our nation with these wide open borders. It's only a matter of time that America, we lose who we are as a free country.
And a white demographic.
And so, and I'm not going to run away. I'm not going to hide from being willing and wanting to go talk to young conservatives about these issues.
If you say nobody cares what Nick Fuentes says, but people care that you're associated with them or that you share a stage with
someone. Again, you're trying to do this guilt by association over and over and over again, and it needs to stop. Because if you want to know who I am and why I went there, I told you that. And, you know, don't assassinate me or my character over...
Don't assassinate me or my characters.
The first request, I think, is fair. Don't assassinate me.
I had no intention, man.
Yeah. The other thing is, you know, I think she's doing a good job with that herself.
Yeah.
She suicided
your character.
She eventually takes off her mic, and this is the point that we have to get to. Again, this is such a treat to have a reporter have, like, this complete uninterrupted questioning of a crazy Republican like this. Keep going.
Over something that any individual that I may ever have met in my life, if there are things that are said or that they believe in, then that's that person. That's not me.
But that's not the first time. My point is bringing up Vincent James.
There you go.
Right? I mean, that's not the first time you've been associated with this group.
Interview's over.
This is Vincent James. He goes by Vincent James Fox, a 31-year-old video blogger and live streamer with a fondness for white supremacist radical right-wing politics. That was the person who she was photographed with. Fox, the father of three, who runs a growing media operation called the Red Elephants, has become RAM's unofficial propagandist after the blah, blah, blah. Basically, he's a right-winger. ProPublica was writing about that.
Very happy with that journalist performance there, but there is one note I would make, and which I think, like, you gotta not go with the so much about the proper nouns of these guys, but say a person who says this.
Yes.
A person who believes this. Because, like, you can't expect... I don't know who that second guy is. I've heard of Nick Fuentes, but I don't know who the other guy is. And you need to just put out, like, do you agree with what they say about this?
Right.
About black people, about, you know...
This person who you were photographed with.
Exactly. Yeah. And then they can say, no, that's bad. Because she doesn't want to say that. Because she actually still is appealing to those folks.
The young conservatives that she talks
exactly.
about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you need to put her on... make her own it or make her not. But this way, she's... still able to skirt around it a little bit.
And another question I would ask would be, why do you believe that these young conservatives want to hear Nick Fuentes speak?
Yeah, do you think that's good or bad?
And also hear you speak. Is there an overlap there that, I don't know, maybe you want to reckon with? But either way, I mean, really well done. And again, like... local reporters, it's a very different dynamic with the state governments there, but I think it sheds light on how theatrical and silly so many of our national political interviews are, because that's the kind of questioning of the our elected officials that is supposed to be commonplace. No longer.
Yeah, and they're going to continue appealing to these folks, like. This has only gotten worse since my sort of professional involvement in watching this stuff on a day-to-day basis for like last like 6 years. They tried to like stop the Steve King stuff, but this is just too important of an energy source for their sort of electoral politics, and they can't be seen saying I condemn Nick Fuentes and that sort of like white nationalism shit.
Yep. All right, folks, we are going to head into the fun half. Maybe we'll bring Binder and Brandon in then, unless you want to do it now. Okay, we don't have them yet. So, but we do have Matt Leck, who had left Reckoning last night, a solo without Griscom. So how'd that go?
It went okay. I attempted a little bit of a pre-half-scripted history lesson into the North Dakota Nonpartisan League, which simultaneously understood the sort of uphill and maybe impossible battle third parties have to go through in this country, but also that being co-opted by one of the two major duopoly parties is almost inevitable. So they ran in the primaries under a sort of farm populism ticket called the Nonpartisan League, which was, we're going to run under any ticket that we can. And I talk a little bit of the success there. Basically, it was led by this guy named A.C. Townley, who was a failed flax farmer and then turned socialist organizer and saw that socialism wasn't really super appealing to farmers, but things like a state-owned grain elevator and State Bank were. And so we talk about his rise and fall. He got arrested for conspiring against the recruitment efforts in World War One, and thrown in jail for 90 days. And later he became an anti-communist crank, accusing the North Dakota Farmers Bureau of being communists in a way that ended the libel suit. So he's not entirely a heroic folk figure, but it's an interesting lesson, I think, in how you do get things done in the electoral system in America, and how you don't.
How you don't.
Yeah. and you know, yeah, how they'll come for you as a communist and throw you in jail anyway. And also Carl Bayer to talk about Russia and their invasion of Ukraine and things like, should the left, does the left lose credibility because we didn't expect Putin to do this? Is Russia doing imperialism? And different sorts of questions like that. Carl's a very concise and to the point thinker. It was good to talk to him yesterday. And we also had Gene Bajelon for a little bit in the post game. Patreon.com/LeftForReckoning to get that.
646-257-3920. We will see you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Unpacked. Matt.
Who?
Unpacked.
What is up, everyone?
Unpacked. Nomi Key.
You did it.
Unpacked.
Let's go, Brandon.
Unpacked.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? You safe?
Yes.
Is it me?
It is you.
Is it me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go for a
ride. Libertarians.
They're so stupid though. Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge me.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3551. One half. 3-8.
9-11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$6,543 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.